the nurse comes back and says, your insurance won't pay for it. And you go, what? They'll pay for the meds that were putting him in a mental stupor, but they wouldn't pay for it. So they went round and round with them. They still can't pay. No, it's a food. We don't pay for foods. So here we were. It was like, God, what are you doing? We finally get to this point and we can't afford this.
I'm Adira Polite, and this is Then God Moved. Hello and welcome to Then God Moved. As many of you know, this is a digital collection of Christian testimonies from around the world. I've been editing and publishing stories on the Then God Moved blog and Instagram page for about a year now, and I think it's time that these stories are told in a believer's own words and voice. So, here we are. Today, you're going to hear from husband and wife Craig and Carrie Miner, as well as their daughter, Grace. They're here to discuss the life and ministry of Grace's brother, Mitchell. In the late 1980s, the family was stationed at Michigan's Wurtsmith Air Force Base, where Craig served as a captain and aircraft commander. Little did they know, the base's groundwater was contaminated. This water, which Carrie ingested during her pregnancy with Mitchell, resulted in a host of birth defects, including microcephaly. In other words, he had a small head due to abnormal brain development. As a result, Mitchell was born a nonverbal quadriplegic. Doctors gave Mitchell a life expectancy of only 5 years. But as you'll learn, God had a very different plan. Mitchell had an incredible purpose on this earth, all of which is documented in the family's book, Overwhelmed, Mitchell's Memoir. If you're doubting God's goodness today, you won't be by the end of this episode. That said, you might want to grab some tissues. It's a tough one. All right, Craig, Carrie, Grace, thank you all so much for being here.
You're welcome.
You're welcome.
I have a bunch of questions for you guys, starting with the days after Mitchell's diagnosis. Craig, you write that you and Carrie quickly developed two very different coping mechanisms, Carrie's being caretaking and yours being work. In reference to your attempts to support one another, Carrie even says, it was like two drowning people trying to save each other. How do you now make sense of that period of time?
In hindsight, I spent too much time taking care of Mitchell. On the other hand, I could not.
Right.
I wanted Carrie to spend that time because, you know, I love my son. I wonder what was best for him. I was glad to give up, you know, my place in life, so to speak, so that he would get the attention and care he needed. And only Carrie could do that.
Right. And as we'll get into a little bit later, it's pretty obvious that she was prepared supernaturally for that role. So as Mitchell grew, things got more difficult. By the time he was 2, he'd begun having seizures and he'd been placed in the wheelchair. And then at age 4, he underwent his first surgery, the feeding tube insertion. Craig writes that the difficulty snuck up on you. I want to know how your marriage changed as that difficulty increased.
So we had our separate coping mechanisms, but we realized that at some point we really needed to merge that back together. You know, Carrie would be all day taking Mitchell somewhere, and she would also be balancing our 3 other children and needed more rest. And only way she could do that was that somehow I took over some of those activities. So, yeah, we began to decide that we needed to have me get out of the Air Force. I was a pilot at the time and get into a civilian life so that I could be there and we could do this together, whatever it was going to be.
Mm-hmm. So that was in 95. Was Mitchell like 6 at that point?
Yeah.
Okay. So you talk about God making it clear that that's what he wanted, like he wanted you to leave the Air Force. How did that affect your identity? Because your identity was very much in the military at that point.
Obviously, God put some big adversity in our lives that made it more than we could actually handle. It even drew us closer to relying on the Lord and listening to what he would have us to do. So through the process of prayer and through the process of lots of discussion, we began to understand that the Spirit was speaking to us to say, you know, it's time for you to go on a different path. You know, going on that path, we had no idea we were getting ready to go into massive, massive adversity, unlike anything we could even imagine. And it's kind of the way God works. If we had known that, we wouldn't have made the right decision to leave the military.
So throughout the memoir, there's this reoccurrence of God saying, in response to your outcries, you are where you're supposed to be.
Yeah.
And there's a scene in the memoir when Carrie's in the car. This is in the early days of you guys moving to Ohio. And she asks God, why would you send me here where there's no one to help me? Can you talk about that?
We were in Michigan when Mitchell was diagnosed. And we had a wonderful church. He had wonderful coworkers. We had friends, just a real good support group. And then we had to move for medical care for Mitchell as soon as he was diagnosed. And in my mind, we were already in a good place because we had all that support. God knows, I would have depended on those people instead of depending on God.
Right.
So it was in that I was driving Mitchell to an appointment or to school, just talking to God, fussing at him really about why did you send us here where we know no one, who's going to help us? And it was just, you know, sometimes you just get this peace and you know it's God's voice. And he just told me, you don't need anyone else. You and Craig have me.
Yeah.
And it was just gave me such a relief that we didn't need anyone else. We had the creator of the world who was going to see us through.
Amen.
Wow. You also write about feeling cheated in the early years, feeling as if you should have been living a different life. For instance, Craig, when you were at church and you were watching kids perform, they were toddlers around Mitchell's age, and you think, Mitchell should be up there. And then you felt the Spirit say, I know that you want him to do all of these things, and he's physically handicapped and mentally handicapped, but you're spiritually handicapped. I thought that was so powerful because he's saying, like, I want things for you that I know will never happen.
Right. I would say that before that moment in time, I really didn't understand unconditional love. When you realize that God loves you unconditionally, like we loved our son, you really begin to understand, gosh, that's how God really looks at me and how much he loves me.
Mm.
It really is unconditional. It was a powerful moment for me. Changed me forever.
Do you feel like Mitchell could sense that love?
I would hold him and he would immediately, his entire stress would relax. And many times he would fall in a very, very deep sleep.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think Mitchell sensed the unconditional love. It's hard to explain the emotional tie. It was more so than maybe normally what a parent would have with a child. Maybe closer to what our Lord has with each of us.
Wow. After you left the Air Force, you guys encountered a lot of financial hardship. Can you talk a little bit about that? Because the sorts of costs that you guys faced are not comparable to what families with fully able-bodied children face. It's a whole other ballgame.
Well, that was probably one of the toughest things. Because if you have mom and a dad with normal children, the mom can go to work at some point, you know, and you can even swap out and one can work evenings and one work days. But when you have a child requiring 24/7 care, which took all of Carrie's time and even part of my time, the financial hardship was phenomenal.
Mm. And how did the church respond?
At first, the church came alongside. Overwhelmingly, they were there and constantly doing things. But then over time, it got quieter. Then it shifted to, well, why are you still in financial trouble? What we discovered is that as believers, as Christians, we're really good at coming alongside someone who has adversity at the moment. But if it's long term, people can't travel with you, or they don't travel with you. And then they're looking for ways to justify why they're doing it. And then it becomes a situation where they begin to attack you, some quietly, silently, some very directly. What are you doing wrong that God's doing this to you and your family?
Yeah.
And that was a very difficult time for us.
Right. Well, you write that you and Carrie probably aged about 20 years during this season. And it doesn't help that Mitchell also had his first major surgery. Could you tell us about that?
Mitchell had to have his hips, they call it, pinned in, because his muscles didn't hold his hips in. And he was in his hospital room. He had a body cast on. So the cast would dry. They would flip him to his stomach for a couple hours, to his back for a couple hours. And it was during the time when he was on his stomach, a friend and I were sitting on either side of his bed, looking across him at each other. And Mitchell's head was facing my friend Sharon. And she said, Carrie, you better come over here and look. Mitchell looks blue. We tried to flip him over. He was too heavy. The nurses came running in. I just remember the people came in so fast. They didn't speak to each other. They pushed me out of the room. And I kept my foot in the door so I could watch. And they just all did their job so, of course, so well. They ended up giving Mitchell a medicine that counteracted the morphine that he was on. And then he started breathing again.
Right.
There just so happened to be somebody from my church that worked in the hospital. And she heard the code blue and knew it was Mitchell's room. Mm. And came running, and she called our church, who contacted Craig. So even in that instance, you know, God was taking care of me and, you know, looking out for me. I didn't even have to call home or anything.
Wow, just incredible.
Yeah. Sometimes we all sit and just talk about times that we went through something, even Mitchell's death. And we just see God's faithfulness and how he just took care of each one of us. And it's very comforting.
Grace, you describe your childhood as a wonderful childhood where horrible things happened. I'm curious about your memories of this period, what you call the poor days.
Yes, the horrible days were just when Mitchell was in the hospital or sick.
How about the caretaking part?
I enjoyed that part because he was like a real-life baby doll. I didn't mind that part, but, you know, just the financial burden. We didn't get to do all the things that our friends got to do.
Right.
People don't understand how poor we were. So I here's an example. I was just looking at our Social Security wages for all the years I've been working. 1 year was $3,000. 1 year was $7,000. 1 year was $4,000. That was our entire income for in a year.
Wow.
Poor was, it was poor.
I mean, we joke about it now because...
Yeah,
my little brother and I do, but we try to explain to our spouses now how poor we were.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, we're like, we were eating the expired Cheez-It that my grandpa would bring us. That's how poor we were.
Yeah. Wow. And you saw God show up throughout it all.
Oh, yeah. All the time. I'm thankful for that because it grew my faith from a young age.
Mm.
I never questioned my faith. One, my parents were an example of following God and trusting him through everything.
Right.
And then watching Mitchell in the hospital be sick and knowing all these people were praying for him. And then that's the only way he got through because the doctors were saying, I don't think he'll make it this time.
Things were really tough for you all at this point, but your faith didn't budge. Craig, you were praying for guidance, praying for a position. And then in 2000, you secured a full-time job as a carpenter at, is it Cedarville?
Yeah, Cedarville University. Yeah, Christian University in Cedarville. Okay. Well known throughout the world.
Right. So it was at Cedarville University where you kind of entered into a battle against pride. What was going on?
What was going on was, you know, I'd left the Air Force. I was an aircraft commander. I commanded B-52s and a crew, and then I was a research pilot. You go from there to selling all your belongings and barely making it. And so when I began to work at Cedarville University, I was pretty bruised up at that point. I had nothing to be arrogant about. And in fact, I knew people looked at me somewhat with contempt. You know, he left something good. And I just wanted people to know that I was capable of so much more. Right. It was very difficult.
Yeah. And how has God worked through that sort of pride issue over the years?
I would say that what God has done is really to let me know that my self-worth is not in my accomplishments and those sorts of things. You know, all the things that we do in this world, any degrees we get or any big things to happen, most of that gets burnt up. It's really not what matters. What matters is that Jesus has got something that's going to keep me engaged and busy with the Father for all of eternity. This stuff on this planet is inconsequential. What he wants us to do is not spend our time developing our worldly self-worth, but work on our self-worth in God's eyes,
right?
Our Father's eyes and Jesus's eyes, because the things that he counts as worthy, I would say 95% of that isn't what I count.
Right.
So while you were working at the university, Mitchell's seizures got worse, and they put him on a medication that made him incoherent. And the doctors basically said, this is his new normal, this is just the way it is. And you, Carrie, were like, no, this is not going to be his new normal.
No.
And God obviously agreed with you. How did that play out?
In the waiting room of a wheelchair store, we were getting Mitchell's wheelchair refitted for him. And I picked up a magazine and read this article about ketogenic diet controlling seizures.
Mm-hmm.
And it named the exact seizure disorder Mitchell had. So I went home with that, stole that magazine. I felt bad. And went home. I think Google had just come out then, you know, looked on the computer, saw that in Nationwide Children's Hospital in Columbus, Ohio, about an hour from us, that they use that diet. Contacted them. I think there was a 4 or 5 month waiting time for Mitchell to get in. But when he did, he went through all their protocol, and then they decided that they would try that for him, and it was miraculous.
Mm-hmm.
It controlled his seizure so well. He was more alert. It was kind of like we got our Mitchell back for a while. It was nice.
And then you were trying to get the canned liquid to take home with you? And what happened then?
So it was the most frustrating thing. We got started on the diet, and his seizures were like 95% stopped. You know, it was like, you know, he was alert, looking at us, and kind of smiling, you know, wanting to be held. You know, and before he was in, it was just a la-la land, like he was drugged and dazed. And the nurse comes back and says, your insurance won't pay for it. And I go, what? They'll pay for the meds that were putting him in a mental stupor. He wasn't here. He was vacant. But they went round and round with them. They still can't pay. No, this is a food. We don't pay for foods. So here we were. We're like, God, what are you doing? We finally get to this point, and we can't afford this. It's like $1,200 a month for this food. I'm sitting at home, and I get a call. I mean, this is all within hours. I'm getting a call. Do you remember applying for the IO waiver 5 years ago? And I said, oh, yeah, I hadn't thought about it. And she goes on and says, well, you know, they changed the rules, and the governor gets to resort the list based on the severity of the handicap, and your son came to the top of the list. You got to understand that we were number 700 on the list, so we were probably 10, 15 years away from ever moving up on the list. And she finally says, well, here's what we'd like to do. If it's okay with you, she said, we would like to cover Mitchell's, all his medical needs, 100%. You know, mentally, I was like, I froze. I couldn't believe what I was hearing. I had to ask her again.
This miraculous move to the top of the list meant not only that Mitchell's medical care would be covered, The government also provided all of the equipment they needed to care for Mitchell, including a new vehicle and all of the wheelchair upgrades he might need. On top of that, they were also given 80 hours of in-home support per week.
What's most amazing about this, it was only a couple hours after everybody said, you can't get this for Mitchell. I went back to Carrie and I said, you won't believe this call. And the nurse was there, stood there like in awe.
Yeah.
And then just started praising God.
Yeah.
And so again, I have to laugh because that's how God works. He's,
right.
He's the God of last minute. And you know, and so, you know, at that point, all you do is just cry and cry and cry.
Later the same year, the year being 2001, during which Mitchell turned 12, he underwent another major hip surgery. Things didn't exactly go as planned. Can you tell us about that?
During surgery, the doctor accidentally dropped his leg on the table, which normally would not hurt a bone. But through that, we found out Mitchell's bones were brittle from his seizure medicine. So we had to have his bone cage to hold his bone together, which, you know, made his recovery much longer. And through that surgery, we also found out he had an illness. Mm-hmm. Mitchell was nonverbal. So when he got ill, he couldn't say, you know, I hurt somewhere. And if he didn't have a symptom, we couldn't tell that he was ill. After that surgery, Mitchell did not wake up. We finally got a neurologist to come in. He knew right away that something was wrong with Mitchell, and he transferred him to the intensive care unit. Mm-hmm. And it was there that they started doing tests, and they found out that his liver was failing. His liver numbers were sky high, and they were saying, you know, we don't know why they're this high. They can't figure it out. There were like five different doctors in there, specialists, who were trying to figure out what was wrong with Mitchell.
What happened is they came in and said, if his numbers come back down, it's going to take weeks. It was clear that they were trying to let us know that he wasn't going to survive this.
Mm. I remember sitting there looking at all these smart men who could not figure it out. But I knew in my heart that God knew what was wrong with Mitchell, and he was going to let us know when he was ready to let us know.
We just did the only thing we know to do. We just started praying, and we started asking our friends to pray. And our friends started reporting how they had friends praying all over the country in churches and groups and people. And
then, as we say, God moved. The very next morning, Mitchell's liver numbers were down, almost to normal. The doctors also figured out the cause of the failure, Mitchell's medication.
One of his seizure medicines gave him chemical pancreatitis.
Mm.
So they immediately stopped giving him that medicine, and his numbers just, whew,
overnight.
And the doctors were just amazed.
Wow.
God just at the last minute stepped right in and said, oh, no, just kidding. You get
not
Mitchell.
Yet.
Yeah, not yet.
After Mitchell was taken off of this medicine, he was relatively stable. Unexpected birthday after unexpected birthday passed, and in 2006, Craig was able to return to the Air Force. The older kids gradually moved out, leaving just Mitchell and the youngest sibling, Levi, at home. Then, in 2011, right before Mitchell's 22nd birthday, he contracted pneumonia. He recovered, only to contract it again in 2014. And that year, he went into respiratory failure. Grace, you were home alone with him when things went south. What happened?
It was Mother's Day weekend, and my husband was deployed at the time, and my parents had a trip planned for that weekend. I think had it planned for maybe a month or so. So I said, oh, go ahead and go. You know, the kids and I will stay with them, and it'll be fine. It was like 10 o'clock at night, got the kids in bed, got Mitchell ready for bed, and I went to the living room to watch TV, and his pulsometer just started beeping. So I went in and his oxygen was like 62. It went back up to 90, then dropped again. And it did that probably 10 times. He started having seizures that wouldn't really stop, which ended up being a blessing in disguise.
Mm-hmm.
Because a few days later, my little brother Levi came to us and said, what did you give Mitchell? Did you give him something? We're like, no, why? He goes, well, come in here, look. And he'd pick up his arm and it would just drop.
Mm-hmm.
And we're like, what in the world happened? And so through calling doctors and asking, they think the seizures caused something. And it made it easier for us to take care of him.
Wow.
Because we used to have to fight him to get him dressed. And,
but he was still just as alert.
Yeah. So it made it easier in the last years to take care of him.
God again said, not now.
Right.
And we're going to make it easier, you know.
More comfortable for him.
More comfortable for him.
Craig and I feel very blessed that our children decided to stay around close and to help with Mitchell on a daily basis.
Right, right. So, Grace, before you met your husband, Scott, was a willingness to help with Mitchell something you looked for when you were dating? I'm assuming any potential boyfriend had to at least be comfortable around him.
Yes, and Mitchell let us know that he didn't like them either. Like, if Scott sat too close to me, Mitchell would look at him and glare. And he never seemed uncomfortable around Mitchell, so.
Okay.
And neither did my sister-in-law.
Sarah, she's a major caregiver.
Towards the end.
In case you didn't catch that, Grace said, towards the end. Mitchell's decline began last April, when Carrie, Mitchell, Grace, and Grace's kids went to the family's cabin in Tennessee.
Grace and I were in the kitchen, and her daughter, Lucy, she's very animated, she said, Uncle Mitchell is dancing. He was having a very bad seizure, and his arms were going up. And we quickly had to give him his recovery medicine. After that, his seizures increased. He just seemed to have lost his joy. He just wasn't himself. I felt in my heart, and I told Craig last fall, that I thought Mitchell was going to die in 2020. And he turned 30 in October, and I really wanted to give him a huge birthday party, which we did. And we invited about 60 of our friends who've known Mitchell for years, and we had just a wonderful time celebrating Mitchell. It was really special. A couple days before Christmas, Grace said, could Scott, the kids, and I come over Christmas morning? And I'm like, well, sure you can. I wouldn't mind. And she said, I just have a feeling that this is Mitchell's last Christmas. So I think in our own way, God was preparing us as best as you can be prepared for that.
And I knew the day he died as well.
Really?
My grandpa died in May of last year. Mm. We took pictures. Next to Mitchell's bed was a picture of Grandpa and Mitchell.
Mm.
And I just thought, that's going to be them soon.
Wow.
I didn't think 2 hours soon. But
I remember the last thing I said to Mitchell before they put him in his wheelchair and took him to the doctor's office. You know, Mitchell, I love you. Last thing I said.
Mm. So they were taking him to an appointment and you decided to stay back?
I was supposed to go with Carrie to take Mitchell, but Gracie came and said that she really felt like she needed to go, so I gave my seat up.
He actually died on the way to the hospital.
Oh, wow. In the car?
We had actually stopped. We were chit-chatting, and I said, why don't we stop and check his oxygen to make sure he'll make it on the tank he has. So we stopped, and I saw this ice cream place. And I mentioned to my mom, oh, there's the ice cream place Katie told me about. You know, we should stop sometime. And she said, oh, well, go ahead and stop because we haven't had lunch. You know, we're going to need something. So we stopped and got ice cream and got back on the road. And I looked in the rearview mirror and he was having a seizure.
Mm.
So if we had not have stopped, we wouldn't have seen it happen.
Yeah, wow.
We were able to try to do everything we could, but it was so fast.
Massive brain hemorrhage.
He had a massive seizure. Well, three, and then just stopped breathing. We rushed into the hospital, and once we got there, that was it.
It was providential that God had them to there right when Mitchell passed. Because if Mitchell had passed with anybody else, they would have
been like, are you sure?
Whoever could. Yeah.
And in that moment, God had answered all of our prayers that we had prayed forever. I wanted to be with Mitchell, and I was right in his face.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I wanted it to be fast and not to have him suffer, and it was very fast.
So that was in January of 2020. At the time of this recording, it's been about 5 months since Mitchell passed. How has the grieving process been?
We still look in his, what used to be his room, to check on him.
Right.
It's a joy because I know he's with the Lord and he's not trapped in that broken body anymore. But I miss him.
Yeah. Just tough because, you know, I walk in the house and the first thing I would always do for 30 years, I would walk in the house and the first place I would go is into Mitchell's room by his side. And,
I wouldn't wish him back. Mm-hmm. And I know we'll see him again one day, mm-hmm. but it's just a longing. And I'm thankful God gave him to us for 30 years.
Right. And not only did you guys have him for 30 years, but the world had him for 30 years. And as you all explain in the book, Mitchell's life was a ministry. What exactly was that ministry?
The ministry is how someone who can't talk, can't sit up, roll over, total quadriplegic, mentally and physically the equivalent of a six-month-old, how him just being there impacted and changed so many lives, that God spoke so profoundly through Mitchell, and he didn't have to do a thing but just lay there. God gave him no abilities at all, and what a ministry he had. It spoke volumes about God and taught people the character of God.
Wow. What were some of those characteristics?
I would say the very first one is unconditional love. Jesus said that loving the Lord your God with all your heart and your mind and your soul, and loving others as yourself, that's what God is all about. He loves us so much, so, so much. And we really don't have to do anything. Mitchell didn't have to do anything at all to get our love.
I never got a hug from him, or "and I love you, Mom," or he didn't make me little things at school like my other kids did, but that didn't matter.
Right.
And that's how God loves us. That's why he gave us Jesus. And that's what Jesus is offering, is that love. And that there's nothing you can say or do is going to break that love. Mm. Not a thing. He just wants a relationship with you.
In the memoir, each of you write that Mitchell was a part of your individual missions on this earth. How did God prepare you for this particular part of that mission?
For me, I've always had a soft place in my heart for people with special needs. In college, I chose to major in special education, and I wanted to teach children like that. Makes me laugh because I didn't ever plan on being the parent of one.
Right. God obviously planned on you being the parent of one. You knew that before you were even born. So it's like you can see that God prepared your heart for this.
I feel like God gave me that love for people.
Right.
For me, God built into me all the character traits that I needed to keep the family together during all the adversity. So many men and families that have handicapped children end up leaving. I want to tell people that it's much greater reward in just staying there and leading. So I think that's what God did for me, was give me the character traits for somehow keeping it all together. And then there's always lots of little things, you know. Mitch always loved to hear me sing to him. And there's just lots of different things that God equipped us with, little things that were for Mitchell.
Yeah.
That's what they were for.
Right. It seems like you see things so clearly in hindsight, maybe even more clearly than you did while writing the book. You wrote quite a bit about your unresolved emotions and the painful memories that you'd been avoiding. How has God worked through some of those?
Well, some of those I'm still working on.
Sure.
But, you know, a lot of times, especially us guys, we get so stoic and we don't really deal with things. And, you know, those things build up in your heart and your soul. They just build up and they build up. And as I wrote my portion of Overwhelm, I began to tie the bow on those things. I got to see them in a different perspective I was just able to put them away. Writing down your life like that, your years of adversity, when you're writing those things down, they force you to face them.
Mm.
Not only that, but it wasn't only healing for us, but Carrie got to read things that I never told her. She goes, oh my God, I never knew this. And I got to read Gracie's. Gracie read ours. We all walked away with such a greater appreciation for our role, what we were doing. What we thought was one thing was really something else.
Right.
The healing wasn't just us working through our own emotions, but working through the emotions together on things that we kind of got wrong.
Mm. And I guess one of those things is actually something that Carrie wrote about, which is asking, why me, for so many years? How did you eventually get past that?
I think the main reason I got past it is I stopped focusing on myself. Because when you ask why me and you're self-focused, you're selfish. And I came to realize that God doesn't do things to us. He does them for us. And it was a process of me trusting that God did the right thing, placing Mitchell in our family, and then trusting that the way Mitchell was purposeful from God.
Right.
No one is a mistake. It took him a couple years to get that through my head, that he did not do that to me as a negative. It was a positive, that he did it for me and for my family.
I'm curious. Obviously, Mitchell was nonverbal, but do you think that he had a faith?
I think he did have a faith, a strong faith. You know, people may wonder why I think he's in heaven. It's the scripture where King David was weeping and sad when his son was ill. And then as soon as his infant son died, he rejoiced.
Right.
Mitchell was mentally like an infant. And for me, I've always looked at that verse as validation that Mitchell is with the Lord.
Amen.
We always said he was talking to his angels. Mitchell would look in a certain area of his room and just laugh.
Right. And then there were also those two major moments that you wrote about. I just loved both of those stories. Can you tell us about that?
The first time, my youngest son was probably about two, and he had played toys all in Mitchell's room. And there were toys everywhere, and I did not pick them up after. We just went to bed with the toys on the floor.
For context, the family never put a guardrail on Mitchell's bed. He couldn't move any part of his body, so he wasn't going anywhere.
The next morning, he was in front of the dresser. The toys were moved. He had a pillow under his head and a blanket on him. Craig said he didn't do it.
I put him in bed.
The two boys, had they have put Mitchell on the floor, they would not have put a pillow under his head or a blanket on him. The youngest son could not have picked him up at that time.
And I couldn't pick him
up. And Grace couldn't pick him up then. So I know, beyond a shadow of a doubt, his guardian angel somehow caught him. He was going to fall out of bed and put him there.
This might sound far-fetched to some of you, but Psalm 91:11. Check it out.
The other time, he had fallen asleep on our couch. And when Mitchell was little and he fell asleep, I didn't move him because I wanted him to sleep so I could sleep.
Mm-hmm.
I left him on the couch. He had his pillow under his head and a blanket on him. The next morning, he was on the floor, but his head was opposite of what it was on the couch. And there was a coffee table there. So it's not like he could have fallen and, you know, twisted his body around. And once again, he had a pillow under his head and a blanket on him. It was his angels, whether they were trying to play tricks on us or what, but they took care of him.
So about the memoir crafting process, where did the idea first come from?
I came home one day and I said, I really feel God's telling us we need to put this on paper. Really, I've been saying that for 2 years. And then one point, God, it was around May, God said to me, Craig, you need to write this now. You know, I'm like, now? You know, and a week later, it's like, no, Craig, you need to write this now. Another week went by, and God said, no, Craig, I mean now. I was having difficulty sleeping. It had to come out on paper. So I went to the family, and I said, oh, guys, I said, we got to write this now. They said, well, you know, it'd take a couple years to write this. And I said, no. I said, we got to write this in the next few weeks.
Did they think you were crazy?
No, this is normal.
But they followed, and as it started to come out on paper, we could just see God moving right in the very beginning. It was like, wow. And I just bawled. I mean, the emotions just welled right up, and it was just like I was reliving it. Mm. And the same thing happened to Carrie and Grace and Levi. It was like, it was amazing. And you got to understand, the entire thing was written in 8 weeks and not
Wait,
much.
What?
Yeah.
Wow.
When we started writing this, God just floated right out. It just went right onto paper. It was amazing watching God speak. So not much changed after that. It was just grammar and that kind of stuff.
Yeah. I want to tell you a story about that. We had a lady edit our book. She actually worked at Centerville University as a lit professor. We knew she had written a book, so we wanted her input before we started. And she told us she was very reluctant to say yes, but God told her she needed to. Mm. And so she came over and talked to us and said, you know, I don't edit books, but I'll be happy to, you know, look over it when you start. And so I sent her the first few chapters, and she said, first, she wanted to apologize. And second, can I please edit your book?
Oh, wow.
And then she said, third, don't self-publish. She had told us before, you should probably self-publish.
Wow. So was she basically saying, never mind, I was wrong, this is actually good?
Or yeah, something? She said she's had a few other people ask her opinions about their writing. And it's really hard to tell your friend, you know, this isn't really good.
Yeah, right.
So she read it and she said, it's actually very good.
And then the one conversation I had with her, she said that she had put off reading the book for a week and a half. And then she said, I decided to start reading it. She says, my husband was out mowing the lawn. And she started reading it. And she goes, oh, my God, this is incredible. And she said, then I yelled out to myself, this is amazing.
This is actually really good.
And then she said that as she edited the book for us, she would go and she'd edit a chapter, and then she'd go in the other room and she'd cry and cry and cry. And then she'd come back and edit another chapter, and then she'd go back and cry. And she said that's how she got through the whole thing.
Yeah, that sounds about right. Were there parts of the story that you were hesitant or maybe even ashamed to share?
I didn't want to share the story about when we had to sell all of our belongings.
Mm-hmm.
But I knew God wanted me to share that. And it was just pride that made me not want to.
Right.
Revealing to people the negative parts of you that were shaped by God over time, it's not easy.
Yeah.
But if it was going to help other people, then we knew that that's what had to happen.
Right, right. So going back to what actually started this all, the groundwater contamination. You all have been fairly involved politically to bring attention to this issue. Is the conversation gaining traction?
I see actions in Congress, and I see activists all over the country. So
it's starting to come out.
Mm-hmm. History books will likely record after the fact. Oops, we messed up on that one. But
yeah, I mean, between improper and even illegal chemical waste dumping to just general negligence, it's infuriating. But I don't sense any bitterness in you guys. There's action that you have taken, but you've all managed to remain so joyful.
We as a family have learned you have a choice. You can either laugh or you can cry.
Mm.
And we usually choose to laugh, not at God, or we didn't laugh and make fun of Mitchell, but we learned that we could always find something to be joyous about.
What an incredible story. What an incredible ministry. This has been a joy.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To learn more about the Minor Families Ministry, visit mitchellsmemoir.com.